Welcome to the conference. Please enter the conference ID followed by the pound key. Thank you. Guest ID accepted.
And good evening, everyone. Welcome to another Monday night installment here at Your Remedy Is in the Law. Tonight, of course, we're discussing various offensive litigating strategies. And this is with our speaker, Mr. David Merlin. My name is Martin Michaels. I'll be your host for this evening's conference brought to you by Your Remedy Is in the Law, which is in direct affiliation with Americans Restoring America. Before we get started with this evening, though, it is very important that I provide you with the following disclaimer.
Nothing that you hear on this call tonight may be deemed by you in any way, shape, or form to be legal advice. If you are on this call because of a situation in your life where you require legal advice, I very politely ask you to hang up the phone. Now, we don't mean to sound rude when we say this. We just want to express to everyone in no uncertain terms that anyone joining this call looking for legal advice has no place or business here. Nobody here at Your Remedy Is in the Law or any of the programs offered by Americans Restoring America is a lawyer, attorney, or any member of the bar. Therefore, no one here is able to offer you any legal advice. Should you require legal advice, my advice to you would be get an attorney. As for these calls, they're all just for entertainment purposes. It's just folks saying what they might do where they're similarly situated to you. You might get a little bit of education out of it, but mainly you're just going to get folks' opinions about what they might do. However educated and experienced these thoughts and opinions might be, they are just people's opinions nonetheless. And it's always up to you to do your own due diligence. All right, on to the next subject. I'd like to go over a few things here with Your Remedy Is in the Law, if I could, very quickly. First of all, if I can take everybody to the homepage of www.yourremedyisinthelaw.com. If we look in the upper right-hand corner, we see a little picture of the Constitution. Click on that, and you'll have a separate page come up with just two items on it. These two items are much important, though, especially if this is all new to you. First and most importantly on the left is the jurisdictionary course. This is your 24-hour crash course on the rules of civil procedure. Better known to some as American jurisprudence or AMJUR, the rules of civil procedure are essentially the foundation or structure upon which all law in America rests. So to have a firm and thorough understanding of these rules means to have at least a basic understanding of what's going on in virtually any court scenario that you find yourself in. On the right is the common law default process, mostly known for its high national win rate in most traffic cases throughout the country. At least that's what it's most popularly acquired for. But that is not really why it's on this page. The reason that we have it up here with the jurisdictionary course is when you go through it, you'll notice that it utilizes all the same fundamental procedures that you learned about in the jurisdictionary course. So it kind of acts as a real-life homework assignment. Also, for a lot of folks, it's their first time committing to action. Folks seem a little more willing to take that first step, probably because of such a high success rate and traffic scenarios being such a common interest in this country today. The common law default, although known purely for traffic purposes, has many other. Truly, it's for most scenarios that you may find yourself in where there's no damage to property or person. It's just some entity is claiming you broke a rule, therefore you must pay a civil penalty. Both of these items are very affordably priced. The jurisdictionary with a contribution of $250 and the common law default at $150. Also on the subject of Your Remedy Is in the Law, most of you are probably familiar now with Americans Restoring America. Every time you visit the homepage of yourremedyisinthelaw.com, you are met with that blue box that pops up asking if you'd like to continue on to the site that you were visiting or stay and visit Americans Restoring America. The reason that we've done this is very simple. We're trying to get folks to explore. There are multiple information providers talking about multiple subjects, as well as many other features and study groups at Your Remedy Is in the Law. And Your Remedy Is in the Law is just one of a couple dozen websites that altogether make up Americans Restoring America. So there's quite a bit for you to see, and we hope that you'll do just that at your leisure. If you have any questions about whether or not we have an information provider that could give you their personal educated opinion about your particular situation, get a hold of us at yourremedyisinthelaw.com, and we'll be happy to assist you in any way that we can. Statewide communications. If you're not already a member, please do sign up. Tell your friends and family about it. That's that map of the United States that you see on virtually every site that we have. It's a private communications platform that enables folks to speak with one another on a local level based on a very strict, pre-decided topics of discussion. Essentially, how it works is this. A wizard will walk you through a very easy setup. You know, put your name in here, click next. Put your zip code in here, click next, that sort of thing. Then it will walk you through the remainder of the setup. And then you'll get to a point where it will ask you, what are your hot points? What are you interested in? This could range anything from credit card issues, home foreclosure, IRS matters, asset protection, or maybe veterans' rights, maybe personal health rights, anything that you can think of. That if it affects your personal rights in one way or another, you should find it in that list or something that's close enough. When the setup is complete, it puts it all together, much like you think of a network. Though nothing like a social network. It's very custom. It's very private. But it then puts you in contact with people in your local area that have similar interests to you. The idea here is to put the power of education and communication back in the hands of the common man. If you are in need of legal advice or you need someone to represent you, you're going to have to get an attorney. It's just that simple. But if there was a way, a private place that you could go to discuss matters, your personal opinions, their personal opinions, with people that were like-minded, maybe you jump online one day and you say, this happened to me today. First person comes back and says, well, I disagree with that. I don't think they should be able to do that. I don't think that's fair. Well, that's probably not going to be of a tremendous amount of help to you. And maybe the next person comes on and says, well, I'll tell you what I would do where I similarly situated. I'd watch these YouTube videos, and then I'd go down there to my local county courthouse, go to the law library, get a law dictionary, and look up these terms. Maybe the next person after that says, those all sound like great ideas. I'd also go to this particular website and check out these educational materials that might assist you in your learning. And then for you to go and do some due diligence on what you're reading, just people's suggestions, people's opinions at all. But if you did some due diligence and educated yourself, maybe the farther you got into it, you discovered that it's not as difficult as you initially thought it would be because you're focused on one single subject. And you get to a point where you've educated to yourself, and now you're handling your own affairs, your own matters. Well, folks, there's nothing illegal or unlawful about that. And that's all we're trying to do here at Statewide Communications is just very simply get people to start talking again. Of course, there's no cost to you for using Statewide Communications, either signing up or the regular using of it. And so we hope that you'll pass that around. Freedoms Radio. If you're over the road, you don't want to deal with the call process, maybe you're just new to your remedies in the law and you don't yet have your username and password, therefore you can't see the phone number and the PIN. By the way, if you'd like to pick up a membership to your remedies in the law, it's very easy. You just simply click the register button. Fill out your basic information there. You'll enjoy the first 30 days for free to evaluate it. After that, it converts to a very affordable $10 a month on your credit card or your PayPal. Every single call is recorded. You have years of archives to go through, a vast wealth of knowledge, as well as many other wonderful features. But if that's not an option for you today, you have freedomsradio.com. Every night the calls go out over the air at 9 p.m. Eastern live. There's also the question bar there where you can type in a question, click submit. As long as that's during call hours, that will pop up on the moderator screen, and we do our best to read every single one of those questions out over the air as long as they are appropriate. So you don't get the one-on-one with the information provider like you would be by being a private member, but you do get your questions answered. There's no cost to utilize Freedoms Radio, so no matter where you are or your circumstances, you never have to miss a call again if you don't wish. All right, winding down here, I'd like to go over one last bit of housekeeping. This is your caveat emptor, or your buyer beware. For any purchase that you may make at your remedies in the law or any of the other sites underneath the umbrella of Americans Restoring America, when you come aboard and you go with an information provider, you are doing just that. An information provider's payments delivered for advertising at your remedies in the law. This payment would be an expense to that information provider along with any other expenses that they might have associated with your particular product or service. When you contact us, all we simply do is listen to your particular scenario, quickly deduce from a list of folks that honestly most of you would probably never be able to find on your own just simply because they can't be found. And we make those introductions. Not every part on the information provider is always going to be successful. everybody always hopes for the best. We plan for the best, and believe you me, we aim for the best. The unavoidable things do sometimes happen, and when they do, you have to roll with them and deal with them as you would with anything else in life. Again, we also want to emphasize, though, that the intent is always to be successful. If you have any questions of that, we welcome you to visit www.yourremedyisinthelaw.com/testimonials and see what others have had to say about these products and services. Now, let's touch very quickly on the subject of refunds or the refund policy. There is none. Not if your remedy is in the law, anyway. Of course, when you call the remedy and you go with a particular information provider, again, that is exactly what you're doing. So any discussion of a refund or a credit would be a strict and private matter between you and the information provider, and even then, that's very few and far between. It must be extenuating circumstances. You are expected to have done your due diligence before you commit to any particular process or information provider's time. All right, lastly, pertaining here to all of the information providers at Your Remedy is in the Law, we'd like you to remind everybody that all of our speakers at these conferences are our guests and should be treated with the highest level of respect. If you disagree with something that a speaker has to say, that's fine. Disagreeing is how we learn, but please, you must always be civil. Besides, if a question is posed properly and then answered properly, then we can all learn something from it.
All right, well, that is my ramble for this evening, folks. So without further ado, it is my pleasure to turn the call over at this time to our speaker for this evening, Mr. David Merlin.
No.
Hey, thanks a lot. Welcome to the Freedoms Radio Call on, I don't know, what is it, the 8th today, May 8th of 2017. My name is David Merlin. Nothing you'll hear me say is intended as legal advice. Anything sounds like that to you, so just consider something somebody else might do on a planet far, far away where the law matters. It doesn't matter here. I prove it on a daily basis. Believe it. So,
ladies and gentlemen, I'll be speaking in just a moment. We've got a problem here with our board.
To the Senate, and the Senate, there's factions in the Senate that say the House version is dead on arrival. They're basically going to start from scratch. So, the celebration may very well have been premature, but the Republicans are at least pushing
there
something. So, and it can only be better. You really can't be worse than that Obamacare. I said that word. I'm sorry. That's filthy language. Previous president, blah, blah, blah. Can't be worse than that. So, I'm here to see what they finally come up with. There's an echo in the back. Michael, is there anything you could do about that?
I'll mute myself.
And
I don't know if Martin's caught the board yet.
Took care of it.
I'm still trying to get my computer to boot.
So we'll see what happens with that. And they better come up with something, because if they don't, the Democrats are going to, true or not, true or false, they're going to come out with a campaign that says millions of people died because of what he did, and they're going to try to take back the House of Representatives. So a lot rides on this, and you can't just assume that we're going to keep the House of Representatives. It's not that easy. Now, very interesting angle on taxes, general issue of taxes. You got many things underneath that. You're talking liens, you're talking levies, you're talking criminal actions, IRS criminal investigations, and I'm talking about, hopefully, and this is what I try to do, preventing people from being indicted when they may have engaged in activity that might permit the Department of Justice to go to a grand jury and get an indictment, like filing Pete Henderson tax returns. Or maybe they filed every year, and then for a couple of years they just didn't file. It could be that easy. So It could be a very simple matter that causes the Department of Justice to seek an indictment. But it might be something exotic like offers in demand, OIDs, whatever that stands for, the Pete Hendrickson tax returns, the international bills of exchange. And you have a category of arguments against the tax code. I'm sorry, you have categories of arguments against the tax code. And the first ones are statutory, of course, because those are the ones that weigh the most. When you make a statutory argument, Congress is making the argument. And so after those.
Okay. Thank you. Finally, I was able to pull this up on my cell phone. I apologize, ladies and gentlemen, for the correction here. Last week before last, when we were doing this call, last week, of course, we had GW here, and it was a wonderful call, absolutely wonderful. However, the week before last, we were doing the two parts so far of the greatest story never told. We talked first about citizenship, that we were thorough on that, and then we covered our monetary system that we presently have today. So tonight, we're going to be doing something a little different. We're going to go to Chapter 3. If you have already pulled yourself up for that, if you've already brought that up, I'll be reading that to you tonight, Chapter 3. Give me one moment. I have to pull it back up because my computer crashed. Between Martin and computers crashed tonight at the same time. Who figures this kind of stuff out? All right, so I've got the story back up, The Greatest Story Never Told. And here we go. Tonight we're going to talk about trusts. One of the first memories of theories raised by those in the patriot community, you know, those folks who are constantly coming up with new and improved ways to defeat certain aspects of the government, usually not paying taxes, is the proposition that the United States government is, in its de facto form, is a corporation by nature. For many years, I subscribed to that line of thinking as well. When this book was first printed, I believe the scenario to be true. I now understand that what most people currently equate as the government is, in fact, a trust. To be more specific, it is an implied, charitable, and resulting trust, foreign in nature, and operating as an insolvent commercial trader within the exterior boundaries of the individual states, i.e., say, the state of Texas, all uppercase. Well, that's a mouthful. And if you don't understand a word I said, so let's do this in pieces. As you recall from the first Chapter 1 that we talked on citizenship, the 14th Amendment passed in 1868, and it provided a new form of citizenship. And it was for the purpose of providing citizenship for the newly freed slaves. To administer over that new citizenship and its members, a public trust was formed. A set of rules and regulations, generally called codes, were passed and implemented by Congress under its plenary authority, the authority delegated over the District of Columbia, its territories, possessions, and enclaves, you know, Article 1, Section 8, Clause 17, to provide protection and benefits to these trust members, as well to place limitations upon their activities. In the period of time between 1868 and 1933, these codes were applicable only to members of the 14th Amendment Trust, that is, citizens of the United States. The period of time the de jure constitutionally created and bound government was still in place and was operating effectively for the American citizen, the American national. There were clearly two classes of citizenry in this country, and it was easily distinguished between them. Furthermore, everyone in both groups recognized and fully understood the differences. Again, at this time, everyone in both groups fully understand and recognize the differences. The fall of the gold system in 1933 had a devastating effect on the de jure republic government. In fact, for all intents and purposes, it brought the individual state governments down. Article 1, Section 10 of the Constitution states, "No state shall make things but gold and silver coin a tender in debts and payments." Do you know of any state today which can meet these standards? Of course not, because none do. Therefore, the de jure republic states no longer are functioning. They're there, but they're not functioning. It's like building a house, lights are on, but nobody's living there. And instead, a de facto government has supplanted them. So exactly what's taken their place? When gold fell in 1933, two operating governing authorities were in place. First, the de jure government was operating for the state citizen, the American national, under constitutional authority. Second, the 14th Amendment Trust was operating for the citizens of the United States who had obtained their citizenship through and and depended upon the 14th Amendment for standing in society. This government included the newly freed slaves as well as anyone who had sought and received citizenship through the authority of the 14th Amendment. This group would include immigrants coming here from other countries and seeking citizenship from the United States. The de jure Republican form of government of the several states was dependent upon the Constitution. Therefore, when the money system required by the Constitution fell, the de jure government necessarily failed because it could not function under constitutional authority with no real money available. However, the trust was not dependent upon the Constitution for authority. Therefore, the fall of the monetary system had no effect upon it. Basically, there is no provision within the Constitution which requires that either the United States or the District of Columbia make only gold and silver coin as tender in payment of debt. Yet to the contrary, Congress was given exclusive authority over those areas to govern just as it sees fit, including the creation of acceptable currency for use in those areas. Suddenly, there was a large group of people, the American nationals, who had no governing authority, and thus they had no services available for protection, adjudication of their problems, defense against foreign nations, among other things. There was, in fact, a large void in this country. The resulting effect was that the trust in place for the 14th Amendment citizens immediately began to fill that void by starting to provide services for the American nationals, you know, the Union State citizens. And by a process known as operation of law, the trust took over the responsibilities that the de jure republic government had been providing. The operation of law is a manner in which rights and liabilities devolve upon a person by the mere application to the particular transaction of the established rules of law, without the act or cooperation of the party itself. In other words, by our behavior, our acceptance, our failure to object, a new governing authority took over. This new authority, referred to as the trust or the public trust, realized its lack of authority over the American national. After all, the American national had done nothing wrong. He had not become bankrupt, and he still owned everything. So a plan was devised whereby the Americans voluntarily turn over authority, their sovereignty, if you would, to the trust. The first phase of that plan was implemented in 1935 with the Social Security Act. The Social Security Act was devised and employed by the trust for its members, and it appeared to be a very benevolent attempt on the part of the trust to provide for the basic needs of its members. Remember, the great masses of lower income people in this country many of whom were already citizens of the United States. They were in the midst of living through this Great Depression, which had been raging on now for 6 years. The basics necessary to sustain life were actually in question for many of these people. There were no jobs, there was no money, and many times no food. To help combat this problem for its members, the trust issued members numbers to each members, and it would then identify them as a member of this trust and establish certain benefits on their behalf. The benefits were very limited at first. A program called the WPA was first placed into effect shortly after the passage of the Social Security Act for the members of the trust. Its function was to supply trust members with jobs so they could feed their family and care for their family. And this turned out to be a noble cause with absolute dire repercussions. Now, my father was the third oldest son in a family containing 22 children, 18 of which were living at home during the Depression years. And although their heritage was as much a part of the sovereign American people, they were poor farmers. Drought spelled what almost amounted to their doom. My grandfather, along with the older boys, sought jobs to feed the family, but none were available. From 1932 until 1935, the entire family lived on a grand total of less than $2 a week. That didn't buy much even then. They raised what they could with a garden that was miserable. They devised ways to kill rabbits and squirrels with rocks and traps, and they fished just to eat. My father reported to me that he never remembered being full in his belly during this time. Well, then came the WPA offering jobs that paid $2 a day. That was an enormous amount of money to them at that time, and as soon as they heard about it, my father and grandfather and two other brothers applied at the work site for a job. Two separate and distinct tables were set up at the work site station, one to apply for jobs, the other to apply for a Social Security number. When my father applied for a job, he was told to go to the other table, get a number, and then he could be hired. He followed the instructions. He was issued a Social Security number on the spot and began to work that day. My family didn't go hungry anymore. My father went to his grave believing that Social Security was the best dang thing that ever happened to him in his lifetime outside of his strong relationship with the Almighty One. I'm extremely grateful that he died before I learned the true nature of Social Security. After the WPA, the trust began adding other benefits, but there was always a price to pay for each. Moreover, the trust was created and operated by the same kind of souls who had forced this country into bankruptcy in the first place, and it was and is their belief that everything in this country rightfully belonged to them because, why? They held the debt. So based on that belief, these parties wanted to start collecting a sharecropper's fee from each poor person living and working on their land. However, they feared, and probably rightfully so, that if they told the people that their land had been taken, that they would no longer own anything, the people might rise up and take back what belonged to them, possibly hanging a few crooks along the way. So a plan was whereby each time more money was demanded from the members of the trust, benefits or services would be provided. It was the plan to make the trust members so dependent upon the benefits offered by the trust that they would never consider leaving the trust and, or for that matter, even challenging the basic authority of the trust. This plan worked perfectly. By 1938, the plan to have the trust as the primary authority within this country had been fully integrated into the court system. The trust, fully commercial in nature, required courts to rule based upon laws of commerce rather than laws of the common law. And to do this, a contract was necessary. The contract, of course, was formed around the Social Security number, the benefits offered through Social Security, and the considerations required from the members to exchange for the benefits. Those who used the number, they were accepting benefits. Therefore, the courts could operate under the presumption that anyone having a Social Security number was a member of a trust under commercial contract and that commercial law was necessarily in effect. In 1938, President Roosevelt released a document entitled Restatement of the Law, which outlines the different usages and effects of law after the bankruptcy of 1933. In 1939, in a landmark decision of Erie Railroad versus Tompkins, the Supreme Court officially made commercial law the rule in all federal matters, stating that except in cases governed by the Constitution or treaties or state law, the commercial law would apply. Here, the Supreme Court acknowledged that there were still those who had and could demand common law, but the great majority of the cases had already switched to commercial law. Another word for commercial law is the code, as in the United States Code. Therefore, the overriding presumption from that date forward was that every case before the court was commercial in nature and should be governed by commerce law, i.e., the United States Code. Anyone coming in the common law would be required to rebut that presumption and prove that he had a right to the common law, that is, he was one of the sovereign American people, of an American national with rights guaranteed and protected by the Constitution, and that he would not then fall under the contract, i.e., he did not have a Social Security number. Before he could be granted a hearing under the common law, this had to be established. The system remains still in effect today, except that now most of the courts do not even have the authority to hear common law cases. So effectively, the courts are obligated to make certain the presumption that any case before them is one of a commercial nature is no longer even required. When you come into most courts today claiming that you have a right to a hearing in law, they simply don't hear you. The matter is totally out of their jurisdictional authority, and that's why you see so many frustrated would-be protesters who run around claiming that the courts are corrupt or that they didn't receive a fair hearing is simply because they no longer see the American national. And this is very important for you to understand with regards to tomorrow night's call with Brother John, how wonderfully effective correcting your political citizenship status works for you. The people's problem is that they've always gone into a trust court expecting to find judicial authority of the Constitution applied, and it does not. It never is. It's just not going to happen because the courts there are legislative courts in nature, exercising the plenary power given by Congress under its authority of exclusive legislation over the District of Columbia, i.e., the United States, its territories, its possessions, and its enclaves. And these courts do not have the authority to hear constitutional issues. After 1939, there still existed the problem of disparity between the people who were members of the trust and those who remained outside the trust, many of whom were part of the sovereign American national people. It was simply becoming unmanageable for the governing authorities. One class of people possessed rights. A class of people did not have rights. They had privileges. The differences were readily apparent. The Civil Rights Act of 1964 was devised to change all that. Cleverly disguised as an act to give equality to different races of people, what it actually did was to raise the benefits, i.e. the privileges, given to the trust members, that is, United States citizens, to an approximate level with the rights owned by the American national, the American citizen. The idea was to make both classes look the same, convince the masses that a citizen of the United States and an American national were synonymous, and then gradually reduce the privileges of the citizens of the United States to a level more in line with what the trust needed, wanted in its operation. The idea was that the American national as a party to the trust, would lose sight of his sovereign standing and allow his rights to be replaced with privileges under this contract. The plan has worked very, very well. If you don't believe that, just go out tonight and tell you all your friends that there's a difference between a citizen of the United States and an American national or an American citizen. And then make notes of the numbers that even know what you're talking about. It won't be a very long list, if there is anyone at all on that list. Then make a note of how many people laugh at you and think you're nuts. And that'll be a much longer list. In fact, it'll probably be everyone that you have spoken to. In order to administer, trust needed some form of rules and regulations. Because most of its members were relying totally upon the trust, it was necessary to have some authority which would serve in its stead of the actual law for its members. Such rules and regulations were created and given the name codes. Codes were established to govern the members of the trust only in their capacity as members of the trust. In other words, artificial beings created by contract or other means. Did you get that? Let's do it again. Codes were established to govern the members of the trust, only the members of the trust, in their capacity as members of the trust. That is, they created artificial beings by contract or by other means. Codes were never meant to govern a flesh and blood man. And as you'll learn later, codes are still not used to govern the flesh and blood man, although they are structured in such a manner as to make one believe they are doing exactly that. We now look at how and where the trust exists and exactly what nature of creature is this trust. First, its name is always very telling. Let's take the name the United States of America. That name was ascribed in the Articles of Confederation. Remember, the Articles of Confederation was where we translated from colonists into the United States of America, the several unions. In fact, it was the several states in perpetual union. That's the quote. And it refers to the union, the states, which joined together and were later incorporated or brought into this Constitution 10 years later. The Articles of Confederation were amended and renamed a constitution for the United States of America. But when the name is changed to all uppercase the United States of America, it takes on a different meaning. The way a proper name is written is with the first letter of each word being capitalized, while each succeeding letter is lowercase. This rule applies unless the name represents an artificial entity, such as what? A trust or a corporation. In state law, the names of the trusts and corporations must be written in all uppercase. Therefore, the upper and lowercase expression of the United States of America is the name of the union of states joined by the Constitution. But the words in all uppercase United States of America, that's different. That would be the artificial entity acting in the capacity of a trust and doing business as a foreign commercial trader. Foreign? Yes, I said foreign, because it is an insolvent entity, witnessed by the fact that it uses only instruments of debt as a medium of exchange and payments of debt. It is obviously foreign to the de jure republic, upper and lower case, the United States of America. The trust is now accepted as the governing authority by well over 95% of the American people. I think probably even 99% would be a closer tag to it. When you mention that you're an American but not a citizen of the United States, you immediately get branded an idiot, a radical nut, or worse still, a terrorist. The demonization process has worked perfectly. So to claim your birthright, you'll have to be well-informed and be very thick-skinned. But the fact remains that the American citizen, the American national, still is as raw, naked, and powerful as it was in the beginning. And if you can prove your birthright, you can still claim the sovereignty that rightfully belongs to you. Now, when you claim your birthright, how do you do that? That's what tonight's call is all about. Next week, we're going to talk about the Internal Revenue Service. But for now, let's go ahead and open this call up for questions and answers. Just press star 2 on your keypad, ladies and gentlemen, to raise your hand. Press star 2, and we'll start the process. Let me go check Freedom's Radio while you're thinking about pressing star 2, and we'll go from there. I think that what we shared tonight is most exciting, most exciting. I'm glad to be able to read it again. It reminded me of a few things that I need to share with John for tomorrow night, before tomorrow night's call. Again, somebody press star 2 on your keypad. Here we go with Brother Bruce out of Texas. Go ahead, brother.
Hey, how you doing? Thanks, and appreciate y'all's time tonight. So if we claim and prove our birthright, is that the same as correcting our political status?
No. Correcting your political citizenship status is something that you do through the State Department of the United States, the de facto corporation.
Okay.
And just as it was in the beginning, when our country, when we were colonists,
right?
When we were colonists, we had people here who were members of the colonies and people who were not members of the colonies, and like us, they were from different countries. There was no organization or way of doing a world census in that respect. When we made our Declaration for Independence, actually before that, I think, when the post office came into being, at some time around there, there was a process by which, just before the declaration, where you identified your status and done under affidavit, testimony, a declaration, so that if you were a New Yorker, this is how it was, and you placed that, you know, with your local authority, which was through the post office. When you go to have your meeting, usually, your general meeting with the State Department, you actually go to a United States Post Office to do it. Nothing's changed.
Okay.
However, there – all right, let's just say, for instance, with my near 30 years of absorbing about tens of thousands, at least, if not tens of thousands of phone calls that I've audited over the near 30 years. I've been blessed in my unique position to be in school every day, and sometimes throughout the with some students, through their teachers, teaching me as well as teaching the student. So if I were brought into court, there's a posture that I would have that a judge would never, in all likelihood in their career, ever seen before. And a confidence in my speech and in my physical posturing that would alert them to the fact, especially if I were to casually drop that their conduct and behavior may have ramifications through a criminal federal court for the deprivation of rights under color of law. They may, especially if not a week or 10 days after hands were laid upon me by a law enforcement officer, and that law enforcement officer already has a federal lawsuit with a case number attached to it that I've filed into this case, may very well consider that to find a reason to make this go away. But that's me. That's not you, for the most part. And the reason that I'm so passionate about these nightly calls is to give you the opportunity to have presented to you the distillation of these 30-some years. John, that's on the call tomorrow night, he's been doing this for over 50 years now, just been coming into 50 years. 45 years, anyways, he's been doing this. Justice Beshear, well into 30 years plus. Now, I do not equate myself as an information provider for one very strong purpose. I'm not an information provider. I don't have that knowledge base with which to teach from. But I am able to parrot back to you the things that I've heard and distilled over the years. So to that extent, you know, I'm a marketer, and I'm just trying to help my fellow man. So to answer your question, can you go into court without having corrected your political citizenship status? I could. I'm very confident. Could anyone else? Most people on this call? Probably not. Maybe one. I'm looking at one here possibly. So the answer to the question is that you want to have an official recording. When we go to, let me see if I can pull this up real quick. When we go to, once we were colonists, let me pull it up here. All right, everything has been so slow tonight and breaking. There we go.
We do have the coronal mass ejection that happened, and which is disrupting communications all over the world somewhat.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. All right, what did I just say to you that I was going to look up?
You didn't. You said, let me see if I can find this, and then you didn't say what.
Okay,
but it was from Once We Were Colonists, you said.
Yeah, that's where I'm there right now.
Something about political status. Well, my question was, does birthright equal political status? And from what I'm gathering so far, that's a no.
Well, your birthright is your political citizenship status. When your birth was acknowledged first, it was acknowledged first, and then
once your status is once your status is corrected, or because if we're claiming our birthright. Or you said if you can prove your birthright, and granted it's with the United States corporation, which we all know is bankrupt officially.
Let me interject here.
Go ahead.
All right. So your birth certificate was the prima facie evidence that went to Washington, to the State Department of the United States. They looked at your birth certificate and said, hey, this boy's born in Texas. He's a Texan. But we're just going to go ahead and put him over here as a 14th Amendment citizen, as a United States citizen. That's what we're going to do.
Mm-hmm.
They did that knowingly, willingly, intentionally. So when you go through the process of correcting your political citizenship status through GW's process that I promote and I execute,
right,
really, 99% of it, you are getting them to correct their records.
Gotcha. Okay.
Okay, so your evidence is your birth certificate.
Gotcha.
So when you go into court, Higgins versus Levine, 415 U.S. 533, quote, the law requires proof of jurisdiction to appear on the record of the agency in all administrative proceedings, which includes civil and the others. Once jurisdiction is challenged, the court cannot proceed, but yet, through their own ignorance, they continue to proceed. It's not what I'm looking for, though. No, I haven't found it. I'm sorry.
That's all right. You'll stop thinking about it, and it'll come to you.
Yeah.
But that did answer my question about the birthright.
Yeah, so if I were in court and the judge was hassling me on it and say, look, Your Honor, let's look up, pull up on your computer on your desk there, Jones versus Temer. It's Federal Supplement, Volume 829, page 1227. This is 1993. It says, quote, the Supreme Court has stated that the Privileges and Immunities Clause of the 14th Amendment protects only those rights peculiar to being a federal citizen. It does not protect those rights which relate to a state citizenship. Your Honor, that prosecutor has not established or is assuming that I'm a federal citizen, when in fact I am a citizen of one of the several states. My domicile is not Washington, D.C.
Correct. Not 10 square miles, which is D.C., right.
Exactly. My domicile, Your Honor, is Florida. I'm a Floridian. Florida being one of the several states in perpetual union under a Republican form of government. Why haven't you forced him to produce that? I've asked for it. Do you realize the jeopardy that you've put yourself under? No, sir, I'm not threatening you. I'm trying to help you. I don't want you to commit this error. The law will prevail. The remedy is in the law, and I'm here to prevail that. I don't want you injured by it. I don't want the prosecutor injured by it. I'm sorry that the police officers that pulled me over for doing 75 and a 70,
you cut out.
The moderator has left the conference.
Hey, I'm back. Thank you for your patience. I unmuted everybody trying to let you know that I was still here. I just couldn't connect. So back to you, Bruce. I lost the last minute and a half of what you were saying. Oh, let me unmute you. Come on, unmute. There we go.
Guards,
there we go.
You were saying something, and then you went dead.
Yeah.
But it was right after you mentioned Jones v. Semmer in 1993.
Right. So the point is that if I were presenting myself in a courtroom, I would have these already put in front of me on the desk, you know, different things, different quotes to talk about.
Right.
So when you correct your political citizenship status, that actually gets marked in the records at the State Department of the United States. I know what it was I was going to tell you. There's a court case that says that it's not a court case. It's in the dialogue itself where it says that the reason for correcting your political citizenship status is so that they may communicate through foreign states of your status. Now that I know what I'm looking for, and I haven't forgotten it, let me go back here real quick.
Great.
If I'm blessed with that. It's here somewhere. Come on. Well, I'm just going to have to go with the memory of it. It's that when you correct your political citizenship status, that is the vehicle that the judge at the bench goes to see whether you're telling the truth or not. So if they see that you're telling, if you're telling the truth by their record on their computer system, they're going to, you're going to have to be able to, you don't have to argue as much with them, is what I'm saying.
Right. Because he's verified that you're not trying to BS him.
Exactly. 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 So that's what I was trying to remember. Oh, yeah, I'm forgetting things. Anyways, any other questions, Bruce?
No, that was a whole lot came out of that one question, but now it makes a whole lot more sense.
Right.
Now, thank you.
Yeah, you're welcome. Would I suggest anybody say, well, I know enough about this, I'll fake it until I make it? No, I'd say absolutely not.
Yeah,
you absolutely need to have your status corrected and recognized by the State Department with your replaced, corrected status, pass card and passport. You may have to dot some I's and cross the T while you're in court. You know, the judge may say to you, this is, well, I show your residence, Bruce, as 123 Main Street, Grand Prairie, Texas. Is that your residence? If you say yes, you just threw everything out the window. Because a residence only applies, only a United States citizen has a residence, which is defined in another court case as being someone who has the right that Congress gave them. They gave them only one right, and that was to live amongst the American nationals in one of the several states of the Union. So any time somebody uses the word residence, that's like, you know, holy water on a vampire. No.
Right. Yeah.
Sign of the cross, keep away.
So your
domicile.
My domicile is one of the sovereign states.
Several states in perpetual union.
Several states of the Union.
Yeah.
Okay. Never a resident.
Never a resident. Never, ever, ever a resident. Only artificial creatures, federal citizens may have a residence somewhere.
Okay.
Anything else, sir?
No, that's great. Thank you.
All right. I appreciate that. Press *2 on your keypad, ladies and gentlemen. Press *2, and I'll be glad to unmute your phone. We'll go through some more Q&A. In the meantime, I want to come over here and check Freedom's Radio to see if anyone has made a comment there. Let me just double check. Well, we've got a good number showing up here. Hello, everyone, and Freedom's Radio. Press *2. If nobody else has questions, we're going to say goodnight, and I don't like doing that. I do want to tell you that this is most exciting. In two of John's active cases with his students, they're right now hitting the judges with the deprivation of rights under color of law. They're doing the step before that, which is mandating that evidence, you know, that is strict, you know, that was produced by law enforcement officers are fruit of the poison tree. So in other words, if they didn't get a court order warrant or judgment to enter your car after you told them no, then anything that they found in that car is they can't bring into the court. And in both of these students' cases, these things are there was never a court order. As soon as that has been denied, then they and the paperwork's already finished. Deprivation of rights under color of law. Bada boom, bada bing. Press *2 on your keypad. I'm going to check Freedom's Radio one more time. Nothing there. I want to thank you all for joining us this evening. I hope to see you tomorrow night. John will be here, and he's going to be bringing you up to date with the As the Stomach Churns, is what he likes to call this saga for Mr. T. And you're going to hear tomorrow night how the benefits are, the leverage and the power you have in court by having corrected your political citizenship status. So until then, good night, everyone, and be well.
The conference is now completed. Goodbye. The conference is now completed. Goodbye. Welcome to the conference. please enter the conference ID followed by the pound key. Thank you. Guest ID accepted.
Thank you. 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 Thank you.